Why is it the same repetitive mistakes continue to rob salespeople of more commission checks, regardless of industry, size of company, or region of the globe? These same inhibitors are holding us back from reaching our full potential. Amongst many industry awards, Ian Selby achieved the accolade of top salesperson in the world at Apple. And in this podcast, he will discuss the issues that sales professionals encounter from his own experiences, confessing to the problems he has endured and how he overcame them, giving the benefit of his wisdom to everyone listening who work in the world of sales. To help you, he will reveal strategies to overcome the issues hurting salespeople and helping you reach new levels of sales success. Confessions of a Sales Pro. Less sins, more wins. With your host, Ian Selby.
Welcome to Confessions of a Sales Pro. My very special guest this week is a gentleman by the name of Chris Beal, CEO of Connect and Sell in Seattle, Washington. For 30 years, Chris has led software startups as a founder or early stage developer. He believes the most powerful part of a software system is the human being. And the value key is to let the computer do what it does well, go fast without getting bored, in order to free up human potential. Chris is currently CEO of Connect and Sell, Inc., based in Silicon Valley, and hosts his own podcast at marketdominanceguys.com. Chris, welcome to the podcast today, sir.
Ian, stunningly wonderful to be here with you.
And I'm so glad you made the time. I know you're busy and you've just produced a book. And so on behalf of our listeners, I'd like to thank you for taking the time, Chris. It's very generous of you today.
My pleasure.
All right. I got a few questions for you. And I'm always fascinated by the guests that we have on the podcast about their backstory, what led them to what they're doing and why did they do it in the first place. And so, you know, how did a physics math guy like you, because that's what you are, how did you get involved in sales and sales tech? How did that all happen?
I think it was kind of a two-prong assault upon my future that happened way back in the day. So one was, I was raised in a house full of books, didn't have any people, really. I mean, I had my four older sisters, but I didn't count them. And way out in the desert, and my dad had all these business books around, and so I was reading, like, you know, Drucker and stuff like that when I was 8-9 years old, and I was just fascinated by the world of business. So that was, you know, that was business, but you get into books like Swim with the Sharks by Harvey McKay, which I still remember in detail, and, you know, sales is a big part of business. In fact, it is kind of what makes businesses go. So there was an interest level there. And then there was an incident that occurred where my first wife, very, very young relationship, had a miscarriage. We were living in Phoenix, about to move to Colorado. And I needed to get money in our hands fast. No health insurance. We're not up where you are in Canada, Ian. So we're kind of on our own on this. And the job I could get the next day was selling door to door. So I became a Fuller Brush man. And most people on this listeners probably don't remember Fuller Brush, but they were kind of like the kings of door-to-door sales of household products. And I just got into it. I thought it was so fascinating, and I came up with a different way of selling rather than you answer the door and I try to sell you something. I actually offered to do research for you and come back if I found something that I really thought would change your life. And I had like a 92% door-to-close rate in a world where 4 or 5% was considered top notch. So that really got me interested in sales as systems. Like, you know, even though sales has been around such a long time, it was so easy actually to kind of analyze what didn't work and just don't do what doesn't work. My mother used to say this to me, Chris, if something isn't worth doing, it certainly isn't worth doing well. Which I always love.
Love that. That's a t-shirt. I love that.
So anyway, that was kind of it. And it's not like I plunged into sales. Then I went off into the world of software and worked for NCR and did a bunch of stuff for government contracts and stuff like that at Martin Marietta. But then decided, you know, I really want to do my own companies. And again, that takes you right back to sales. I mean, you start, you know, doing companies. I was always the CTO, that thing they call now a technical co-founder. but I always found myself as being the top sales rep as soon as the product was built enough, or even not before then, so I could go out and talk to people about it. And I learned very early from building companies, and this is going back into the 80s, like 1983, 84, when I started doing this, that the key to building great products is to sell them before you build them. And that's actually been my guiding principle ever since. And that's why, you know, I am where I am right now about, you know, and the company is all about helping other companies sell their innovations is, well, I realized that we tend to sell too late. We tend to think we should build and then sell, but the order that's most effective is to sell and then build what you sold.
I love what you said there, Chris. And that was a fabulous backstory. I totally remember the book Swim with the Sharks, a beauty, and still on my shelf this very day. It's a little, you know, long in the tooth. It's been read a few times, but a fabulous read by McKay for sure. And you cut your teeth in sales at Fuller Brush, and it look, 92%. You've got to share, like, throughout our discussion today, some of your secret sauce. That is an amazing, you know, doorbell to purchase order ratio. That's a remarkable. I like what your mom taught you about it. Something's not worth doing, it's not worth doing well. So I've written a white paper myself called The Seven Deadly Sins in Selling. Same idea, seven things to stop doing and you'll already be better, right? So we're on the same page with that, absolutely. I like what you also said, Chris. Sell it first, then build it, because the customer becomes the architect. They will give you the insights as to what it should do or what it doesn't need to do. And there's some brilliant science in what you just said there. It's fascinating. So, you know, in a world that we live in today with business to business, business to consumer, I've heard a new term recently called prosumer, and that's a hybrid somewhere in the middle. What do you see as the most important difference between B2C and B2B sales, Chris?
Well, it's a great question. It's in a funny place that I don't see people talking about. So there's a lot of talk about the convergence of B2B and B2C. Well, let's say, you know, B2B is going to be more and more like B2C over time. The B2C leads and B2B follows. That's sort of the theme that's out there. And surely B2C, especially online, is super sophisticated now, right? You feel like they're tracking your heartbeats and your eyeballs moving around when you're not even on your computer, because they're always telling you what you want to buy. That's always what you were just thinking about 10 seconds ago. But the difference is huge in one area. In B2C, you risk your money. In B2B, you risk your career as a buyer. And there's a big difference between your money and your career. Like, say I were to buy a Tesla, right? I've always admired those things, and everybody else in my company seems to have one. I got a Tiguan, so, you know, close. And so say I buy a Tesla, right? I drive the thing home and I love it and it's all great. But over the next week, I develop an awkward rash in the sitting area. And it's like, what's going on here? So I go to my doctor and the doctor says, Chris, I hate to tell you this, you're allergic to electricity. It's like, really? I didn't even know that was possible. So sorry, dude. Electricity. Have you bought a Tesla? Because those things run on electricity. I say, yeah, but you got to get rid of it. So I dump the Tesla. What am I out? You know, $8,000-$10,000, something like that, for being dumb enough to buy a new car and then sell it as a used car 2 weeks later. And I'm out a little bit of money. I make that money back over time. I might have some embarrassment or whatever, but there you go. I buy that same priced item, that $60,000-$70,000 system for my company, and it doesn't work. It creates an allergy within the company, and I'm the one who pushed it. My career is damaged, and my career is worth a lot more to me than $8,000, $9,000, $10,000. So B2B buyers are super, super cautious. And B2B sellers often don't get it. There's a quote in Anthony Iannarino's latest book, Elite Sales Strategies, that opens the book, opens the introduction. And if I can remember it correctly, it says, people buy from people they trust to make a decision they don't trust themselves to make. And that's the essence of B2B. And so your trust threshold you've got to get above is above the buyer's trust in themselves. That's a pretty high threshold. And that's why no decision is the most common in B2B, and it's not the most common in B2C. must come and outcome in B2B is they do nothing. Everybody goes, oh, it must be because one of us sellers didn't outsell the others. It's not, no, you've all failed to clear the bar, which is you've got to end up with the buyer trusting you more than they trust themselves.
Wonderful quote. I really, really like that quote a lot. And, you know, to summarize a little bit of what you said, Chris, in B2B, you're risking your career. And that's what can make people slow to make decisions, the overly due diligent when it comes to selection and all of those things. And as sellers, we get frustrated sometimes wondering why deals are like slow motion walking through your pipeline. And it's not about you, it's about them. In the B2C world, you're risking your money. And you can, as you said so well, you can make that up real quickly. So there is a convergence going on there. There is some kind of weave together with B2C and B2B for sure. So you cut your teeth selling Fuller Brush door-to-door in sales. I cut mine selling typewriters. Now, most of our listeners don't even know what that is, but electronic typewriters door-to-door. It was business-to-business, but old-fashioned cold calling, door knocking. So we've both been around long enough to know what cold calling is all about. I'd love to get your take on this one, Chris. Why do you put trust before value when it comes to cold calling?
Yeah, cold calling is really, really interesting. It, you know, cold calling, when you knock on somebody's door, you have a big advantage. I remember this in Fuller Brush. I got so much information back from that person's stance, their body language, their facial expression, the timing, how far they opened the door, you know, this flood of information, right? And so I could use that information, hopefully intelligently, to help that person reduce their apprehension, their fear of me, and potentially trust me. Right? In cold calling on the phone, which is what we help people do here at Connect and Sell, it's a little harder because all I've got is the other person's voice. It's still a lot, but all I've got is their voice and my voice. And so if I go to value too soon after I ambush somebody in a cold call, because a cold call truly is an ambush that elicits fear in the other person. Because when I call you, You're dealing with me as the worst thing in the entire history of the world, which is the invisible stranger. And the invisible stranger is the people from across the river. We don't like them, right? They paint their faces vertically and we paint ours horizontally. And when they're invisible, it's nighttime and they're here in our village. This is bad, right? So we have a primal fear of invisible strangers. And when we cold call, we are the invisible stranger. And we have, according to Chris Voss, FBI hostage negotiator, now guru of many things, and he knows what he's talking about. He says we have 7 seconds to get somebody to trust us in a cold call on the phone. Well, 7 seconds isn't very long, certainly not long enough to start talking business value. And anyway, what's wrong with us? Do we really think somebody's sitting there waiting for a salesperson to call them and tell them how to run their business? Like, first thing, it's just not there. It's just not there. So realistically, we need to take the emotional journey of the prospect from fear to trust, and then not even to value yet. We got to take them to curiosity, because they're not really ready for anything other than getting off the phone, and we got to get them curious enough to take a meeting. So the emotional journey of a good cold call goes from fear, the buyer's fear, not yours. Yours is irrelevant. You got to get over it. But the buyer's fear to trust, to curiosity, and then the commitment. And the commitment's just to a meeting, because that's the only product we're selling right then.
Right. And you know, I see that myself. I love what you said. Face-to-face feedback, it's a way richer environment to observe, understand, hear, look at the body language, all those things. But when you're on the phone, all you really have is tone and words to decipher, to figure out what's going on. 7 seconds to trust. That is amazing. I love that idea. But that means we're running, it's a sprint. This is not a marathon to try and establish that. The emotional journey from fear to trust. And if you put, I think the bridge over that river, as you mentioned, Chris, is to generate curiosity. That's what you talked about. I think that's fascinating. And that's hard to do on the phone. I've seen some salespeople get it wrong, and I'm sure you have as well through our years, that they're on the phone and they're thinking they're trying to get an order. All we're selling is the meeting. Why an investment of 20, 30 minutes could have an ROI based on this curiosity you've generated. You're not trying to get the deal on the first phone call. That's the wrong expectation to have. So I really like how you phrase that. I like how you put that into context for everyone. And there's so many trends going on out there, right? The world's, it's coming at us fast and furious. Chat, GPT, and all of the artificial intelligence trends, given all that chat about that, will there always be a role for humans in B2B? You think of the movie, you know, The Matrix and all these things where, hey, that's not that far-fetched when you think about what technology can and is capable of. Is there always going to be a job for us folks in business-to-business sales?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. And the reason is right in that trust question, the need for trust in B2B, which is never going to go away. Because that business of, you know, you're risking your career, that's never going to change. B2B is fraught with peril for the buyer, and the buyer's got to trust somebody, and the buyer will never trust the vendor's robot. Vendor's robot's always going to lie to you. Vendor's sales rep might lie to you too, but you've got, as a human being, pretty good lie detection capabilities when somebody's speaking with you. And you can probe a little bit, and you'll do it unconsciously, subconsciously, and consciously. You're trying to determine, is this person on my side, and are they actually an expert? Those two things, if you can get those, you know, in your mind as the buyer and in your heart, then you can move forward to explore. But the vendor's robot is never going to be reliably on your side. It's the vendor's robot, right? It's a little hard to get its loyalty to move over to you. And what is it going to do in order to get you to trust it? So ChatGPT, by the way, is fascinating to me. I actually recently, with my podcast co-host Corey Frank and our podcast publisher Susan Finch, we recruited ChatGPT to write a book. And the thing was to take our podcast and turn the first 25 episodes into a book by having ChatGPT write the book. Now, the book is not particularly good. It's not terrible, but it's not particularly good because ChatGPT, I'll say, is a little soft and our podcast is a little edgy. So it's like it softened it up. But we had it summarize 25 episodes and I asked it questions and all that. And I guarantee you, it is awfully, awfully good. But, and you might trust it with stuff that you're just thinking about, like, I don't know, you know, is this wart on my nose something I should be taking care of? And you might do your research with ChatGPT, and it'll be pretty sound. But when it comes to actually determining whether that wart is cancer or not, you're going to go to a live human doctor who you know is on your side. You're going to go to an expert. When the stakes are high, we don't trust AI. I just made that up. I feel like Muhammad Ali or something.
Wow. That's a beauty. That's a beauty. That's got to be the next episode of your podcast, Chris.
I like that one. I'm going to keep it. It just came out of my mouth right now.
That's beautiful. Wonderfully said. And I mean, it makes sense. Robots are programmed to do something. And no matter how good of a code writer you are, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to create trust. That's a human-to-human experience, right? I know B2C, B2B, it's H2H, it's human-to-human, and that's really what you're saying. When you were talking about, you know, lying robots, it made me think of an old joke that the difference between a car salesman, a used car salesman, and a technology salesperson is that the used car salesperson knows they're lying.
Exactly. I love it. Yeah, that is actually so true. That is so true. And by the way, the irony is the used car salesman who doesn't lie is the one who puts up the big numbers.
That's it. There you go. There's a differentiator right there. That's how you stick out above the crowd and have integrity, even in a world that's typically, you know, associated with not having too much integrity. So it's interesting. You've been, you know, Mr. Startup. You've launched companies throughout your career, successful ones, grown them. And, you know, we always wonder, you know, the founder, the CEO, what's their job? I mean, they've got to do a lot of things, right? Like to start a company, like push that first rock up the hill and get some momentum going. you know, what role should the founder play in the world of sales at a B2B startup, Chris? What's your experience? Because you've done this.
Yeah, to me, the founder's got to be the first salesperson, and they've got to keep selling throughout the life of the company. If you don't sell, you lose touch with the reality of what's going on with your customers. And you retreat into data, and you retreat into people's opinions, and you think you're delegating something that makes sense, which is sales. And sure, you know, you want to scale it, and so you're going to delegate bunches of it. But if you really want to stay in touch and see that next thing coming before it hits you too hard, it's good to spend some of your time every day out of the front line selling. And I know a lot of founders are uncomfortable doing this because they're techies and they think that sales is either, I don't know, trivial, like, hey, compared to my wonderful engineering brain, you know, you don't need all that to sell. Well, trust me, you need a lot to sell. Sales is not just a reactive kind of personality-based thing. It needs to be engineered. And then it also needs to be wrapped around your offering. And as your offering is changing in the marketplace, as people are using it in different ways, as competitors are showing up, as pricing pressure shows up, as ChatGPT shows up, you know, you can learn secondhand, thirdhand, fourthhand eventually, but if you want to learn right now, you got to be out there selling. So that's kind of thing number one. The other thing I think that's just big for founders and founder CEOs is your number one job is to keep parasites out of your company. And this doesn't have to do with sales per se, except for one thing. Often somebody presents themselves as this wonderful chief revenue officer, VP of sales, whatever, is actually a parasite. And they're really good at hiding it. And when they come in, they're coming in for themselves, not to be part of the mission. And the hardest thing about new companies is keeping the culture aligned with what it's needed out there in the world to be successful. You got to be coherent. And that first parasite you hire because you think they're super talented, that's your biggest mistake.
I like what you said there. I mean, the first salesperson and always be in touch with the customer, that's their role. And even once you start to scale and grow and add a couple of layers, stay involved on the front line. Stay in the game. I call it the four-legged sales call. And that's not me on my hands and knees walking in begging for the order, though I have done that in my career. That's a four-legged sales. Go on calls with your salespeople. Go visit customers and prospects and stay, you know, keep your radar wide open for what's really going on today. Because when they first did it, likely years ago, that landscape has changed. Change happens all the time. You reference a number of things. So, and you got to watch out for the parasites, Chris. I totally agree. Oftentimes, a VP of sales or a chief revenue officer, their best sale is their interview. And it goes downhill from that after that. So
yeah.
you got to be on the lookout for that for sure, Chris. No, that's wonderfully said. Chris, once again, on behalf of all our listeners, thank you so much for taking the time today and sharing these pearls of wisdom with us. It was so nice to have you on the podcast.
Oh, Ian, it's fabulous. Love what you're doing.
That's great. Thanks again, Chris, and thank you all for listening to Confessions of a Sales Pro.
If you have found this episode informative and helpful, we would be honored and appreciative if you would share this podcast with other great salespeople like yourself. And we look forward to you joining us for all new episodes weekly, every Thursday. Please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. If you'd like us to help you grow your sales commissions, visit us at salesmentoryou.com. Confessions of a Sales Pro. Less sins, more wins. With Ian Selby.